This is really the victory.
Join us and hear the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to start today with some good news about our nation's schools. A new report shows that U.S. public high schools have reached an 80% graduation rate. That data comes from the National Center for Education Statistics. We wanted to find out more, so we've called upon Emily Richmond. She is the public editor of the Education Writers Association, and she joins us from member station WABE in Atlanta, Georgia. Emily, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
It's a pleasure to be here, Michelle.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Daniel Gull. He is the chief academic officer at Houston Independent School District. Texas is one of the states that ranked near the top, and he's with us from Houston, Texas. Mr. Gull, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Hello, Michelle. Glad to be with you.
So, Emily, let me start with you. How significant is an 80% graduation rate? Is this an all-time high?
It is an all-time high for the United States, and it's an important milestone for that reason, but also because it suggests the country is on track to hit an ambitious goal of a 2020 graduation rate of 90%.
Whose goal is that?
Well, there's a coalition of organizations that have come together to address both the dropout rate and the nation's struggling graduation rate, and they're the ones who put out the report Monday based on the new federal figures. So you have the Civic Enterprises, the Everyone Graduates Center, which is at Johns Hopkins University, American Promise Alliance, and the Alliance for Excellent Education. So that's what the researchers are projecting, and it's something that those groups would hope we could hit.
Well, it's, more broadly, is it now generally something that the country as a whole, if you just think, you know, parents, public officials, do we kind of generally have a consensus that we want to get to 90% and that we can get to 90%?
I think it's a realistic goal based on the numbers that we're seeing now, and that should give people a lot of hope. But we need to talk about who's not in that 80%. There's 718,000 students who dropped out of what would have been the class of 2012. That, as Education Secretary Arne Duncan said yesterday, is a group of teens and young adults that is larger than the total populations of Wyoming and Vermont. Hmm. And we know that a high school diploma is the bare minimum for even marginal employment. So that means for students who fail to graduate, that achievement gap quickly becomes an opportunity gap that's going to persist long after their classmates have walked past them across that graduation stage. Hmm. And it's a gap they're going to struggle with for the rest of their adult lives.
All right. Well, let's hold that thought, Emily Richmond, and let's hear more about the success part of it. And we'll still talk a little bit more. We'll wait a couple of minutes to talk about what still needs to be done. Let's focus on what's been accomplished so far. So the aptly named Daniel Gull, you work with the Houston Independent School District. Texas was one of the top five states in high school graduation rates, graduating 88% of students. What do you see as the most important factor in achieving those numbers?
To me, the most important factor is laying out the expectation in every community, both within our urban centers as well as in our most remote and distant rural areas, that we expect the public commitment to public school dollars being spent to result in student achievement. And that is best identified not through test scores, but by a high school diploma. It is a certificate that it is not just the level of what you know, but your ability to attend on time, your ability to complete expected tasks. As we enter an era when all of our students will have been born in the 21st century, we need to ensure that the public dollars are resulting in a public return in the future, which is why we have public schools.
You have to note that part of the improvement here came from a significant jump in graduation rates among students of color. John Bridgeland is one of the authors of the report. He talked about this on the PBS NewsHour on Monday. Let's play a short clip from that conversation.
The most significant gains in graduation rates have actually been among Hispanic students and African Americans since 2006. And these students, half of African Americans and 40% of Hispanics, were trapped in these dropout factory schools where it was literally a 50-50 proposition whether you graduated or not.
So, Emily Richmond, back to your point about who was being left out, and where were these dropout factory schools that Mr. Bridgen speaks of, and what happened to the students after these schools closed?
Well, a lot of them were in high concentrations of urban areas, and it's important to say that they're still there. We know from this report that the number of those schools has declined by about 33% in the past decade, and we believe those students have been transferred to more successful campuses or alternative programs. But over that same period, you have to understand it's not just about shutting down an underperforming school. It's making sure that that student lands somewhere that they're going to be successful. So the questions we have to ask is, what is working? Is it that they've been transferred to more successful schools? Are they getting into better programs? Or in some cases, a question that's been raised, I think, fairly is, have states changed their graduation requirements in some way that it's made it a little bit easier, has lowered the bar so that more students are graduating?
So Daniel Gold, maybe you can help us with that question. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about high school graduation rates, which have reached an historic high. We're speaking with Emily Richmond of the Education Writers Association. That's who was speaking just now. And Daniel Gold of the Houston Independent School District, Texas, is ranking among the states with the highest graduation rates. So Daniel Gold, can you help us with that? What are some of the success factors? And are we in part, you know, people always ask this question when numbers look both good and bad, depending on their point of view, is are we changing what we're measuring to get these numbers?
Well, we constantly are changing what we're measuring. But the important thing is that we have now entered the second stage of our standards movement. And while graduation used to just be about the accumulation of credits, right? You had 4 years of English and enough electives and math, all of that put together. Many states have now instituted some form of testing, whether that's a graduation test of what you need for literacy at the high school level or subject-based exams, and of course exams for an Algebra 1 or a geometry. Many states have moved to that, and that actually represents a raising of the bar from previous generations. What has helped is that we are now able to be clear with students as to what level of achievement they need to make. We can measure where they have gaps, and we can work with them. Now, Houston, as in many cities in Texas, has done things to extend the ways in which we can get students to that bar, that they have night school if they need to work during the day, that they have multiple options to choose from, not just the dropout factory, which may be in their zip code. So by introducing a number of ways that students can find the right fit for a program, but at the same time hold the standard, we're able to be flexible with the how, but make sure that the degree is meaningful, because the high school diploma must equate with college readiness, workplace readiness, without remediation.
We talked about the ethnic factor here in the quote that we heard earlier from Judd Richmond about the large numbers of African-American and Latino students who were trapped in these dropout factories in Houston. You know, more than 60% of the students are Hispanic, and nearly 25% of the students are African-American. So were there specific, obviously there's a lot of diversity within these groups. I mean, I think, you know, that has to be said. But did you find that there were specific techniques that you felt that were particularly successful? And were any of them driven by particular circumstances that you felt were particularly successful with students who had not been previously succeeding?
So in 2007, our graduation rate was 56% here in Houston. And in 2013, we're up well over 80%. And we're trying to beat the state and lead the nation to get to that 100%. But here are the things that we've tried and have proven very successful in moving that bar. That is making sure more of our students are successful. Every student has a credit recovery lab, because if you're missing an English 2 credit and you've been in high school for 5 years, you'll never walk the stage. But you're not going to sit with 14-year-olds when you're a 19-year-old. So allowing students to master those skills in their own time, in their own way. We've opened 7 night high schools throughout the city where our people were able to go. Every campus has a dropout prevention, which equates to a graduation promotion committee to track every student who is at risk. And there are many different metrics and methodologies to do at risk. What's important is that every campus defines it, measures it, and intervenes. Those are 3 top interventions that we've been able to introduce.
So, Emily, let's loop back to where you were trying to take us at the beginning, which is the kids who are being left out. If 80% of students are graduating, that means that 20% are not. So tell us a little bit more about the students who are still being left behind.
Well, we know for a fact that there's a lot of variance once you start getting into what that 80% means. And when you start to peel down by student subgroup, there are still significant and troubling disparities in achievement. You talked about some of the ethnic disparities, but there are also big gaps by socioeconomic status and other subgroups of students who typically struggle academically. For example, nationally, the graduation rate for economically disadvantaged students was 70%, and I counted 14 states where at least a third of those students failed to earn a diploma. For English language learners, it's 59% graduation rate, and in 9 states, at least half of those students failed to graduate.
So Dan O'Gole, will you give us a final thought here about, are there things that you feel are scalable, things that you're doing in Houston, in Texas in general, and Houston in particular, that you think are scalable, that you would want to recommend to other states if you feel comfortable doing that?
To my fellow professionals, I'll ask them to continue to examine how they're making sure that students are able to make up previous mistakes, that we do not hold permanent the mistakes of youth to prevent them from graduating. That's the dropout recovery. That's the credit recovery. That's making sure that programs are available in their neighborhoods to able to do it. The other thing is that high school cannot be a monolithic definition, that we need to ensure that there are programmatic variations that add an effective appeal to why you want to graduate from high school and not just some future promise of return. Make it interesting. They will come, they will complete, and they will move to success.
Do you feel proud about this, Mr. Gole? I mean, you're being very, I appreciate that you're being very kind of professional about it, but I mean, is there a part of you that
we are tremendously
feels a little bit
proud.
Of a ready for a chest bump here?
We are tremendously proud. And having 4 out of every 5 students who enter our district successfully complete is a great move forward.
Did you think you would see this in your professional life?
It's why we all go into it. So, yes, I hoped we would. It's not as soon as I would have hoped, but it's sooner than I feared. And we got to get to 1 out of 10 and then close it to 1 out of 20 and just keep moving that needle.
All right. Daniel Gole is Chief Academic Officer at Houston Independent School District. Emily Richmond is the Public Editor of the Education Writers Association. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, so there's no such thing as free money, but how about money that's yours, but you forgot that you had?
The biggest way people get out of touch with their money is they lose touch with the businesses that have it.
We'll ask our money coach how you can get back what's yours. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Things are so bad in Iraq now. When journalist Dexter Filkins interviewed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, their teacups were rattled by a car bomb. Iraq holds parliamentary elections Wednesday, and Filkins says Maliki is trying to dismantle any checks on his power. On the next Fresh Air, Filkins talks about his New Yorker article based on the 4 weeks he just spent in Iraq. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Right now, I am happy and I'm sad. I'm happy because it's time for Muses and Metaphor, our very own ode to National Poetry Month. This year, as we've been doing every year throughout April, we've been featuring original Twitter poems written by NPR listeners. Thousands of you have participated. New this year, some of our regular contributors have also weighed in. But I'm sad because April is just about over. So it's time now for our final roundup of Twitter poems for this year. We had to go out with a bang. So joining us now are not one, but 2 winners of the prestigious Kane Prize that awards the best English short stories by African writers. In studio with me here in Washington, D.C. is Tope Falerin. He won for his short story, Miracle. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us from Dakar, Senegal, is Binya Vanga Wainaina. He won for his short story, Discovering Home. He was also recently named one of the most influential people in the world by Time magazine. So, Binya Vanga, welcome back to you. I think I should call you Excellency or something. I'm not sure.
Oh, gosh, no. Thanks, Michelle.
Well, congratulations to you both. It's wonderful. So, Tope, will you start us off? Would you mind sharing your Twitter poem with us?
Okay, the one I drafted is a poem that is in some ways inspired by the story that won, which is a part of my novel. It's called Sermon. The pastor cries, "Lend me your ears." The collection plate is passed around. We cannot hear the screams when he begins to munch.
Wow. What inspired you?
Well, you know, I'm really inspired by... There's a poem by Carolyn Forché about, I think it's called The Colonel. And at the end of the poem, you know, the ears fall to the floor. It's a really kind of graphic but simultaneously powerful poem, and the ears fall to the floor. And there's an image of some of the ears pressed to the ground and some of the ears up, and they can hear. And so I thought it'd be interesting to kind of mix that image with the image of the collection plate, which is a ubiquitous image with respect to churches, and to kind of somehow try to combine those and to show how people, when they go to church, because they're in a place of faith, they'll do whatever the pastor asks them to do, even if, you know, they're in some ways risking themselves, their own lives, and that sort of thing. So,
shades of Mike Tyson, yeah.
I suppose one could say.
All right, well, thank you. All right, Binya Vanga, you ready? What about you?
You omit a bibliography from your poem. Silenced and bodies unsilenced. All are silent. All except fellow bibliostudy tweeps. Hit reply.
Oh, and what inspired you?
I don't know, like, I have this love war hate thing with poetry often, sometimes, and grappling with. And also, you had this season of really amazing poetry during our election. There was also this question of, which now has become a thing, of things that roll on your Twitter handle, and then you're like, I feel guilty, but then, like, I don't feel like I want to engage. But why don't I want to engage?
What did you think of the form, by the way? You said you have a love-hate relationship with poetry anyway. What did you think of the form? Did you like it? Did you find it challenging, annoying, or what?
Terrifying. Meditated too. But I guess that means that it's good.
Tope, what about you? How did you feel about the form, just having finished your novel?
Yeah.
Did you like it? Did you hate
it?
I loved it.
You know, before I started writing prose, I spent about a year and a half doing nothing but writing and reading poetry. And I think in many ways that's what prepared me to write the novel, this kind of deep and fierce engagement with poetry. And so it's a form I quite like, because it's a form that forces you to kind of cut away the fluff, cut away the stuff that isn't necessary. And that's something I strive to do in my prose as well. So I really appreciate it. And I was also inspired by many of the poems that I read, you know, so it was obvious that a lot of people had packed in a lot of emotion, a lot of longing, a lot of feeling into their poems, and I wanted to do the same.
Well, speaking of which, Tope, you were nice enough to look at some of the poems that came across on Twitter. Again, we used the hashtag TMM Poetry. What were some of your favorites?
Sure. So there's a couple poems by somebody named Sasha McLeod. At least that's her Twitter handle is McLeod_Sasha. And she has a poem that goes, "I begged him to ask me a different question." Which I think it's an incredible poem, because it's a poem that it's almost like a doorway between two realities in a way. It's a poem that's at the threshold right before something traumatic happened, or perhaps right after something traumatic has happened. And I think we've all been in that moment when we're at that moment of crisis or that moment of transition, that moment of change, and we want to go back in time and we want to beg the person who is asking us to do something or has told us something we don't like very much to kind of go back. And so I thought that poem really captures that feeling, that sort of sense of fear and that sense of change.
She has another. Any others?
Yeah. Another one by her that goes, "Where have I been all of my life?" It's a kind of existential crisis poem, I suppose you could say. And it's a really... So having been through a few of those myself, I can relate to the sentiment. And there's one more I like to read. It's by... his name is Boiarski, I believe. It's Boiarski. And the poem goes, "Common onion layered with pliant, translucent imitations, echoes of itself, shows us the power of ordinary things, and we weep. And the reason I love that one is because it kind of captures the essence of Onion. It kind of goes into the way the onion looks, the way echoes of itself is a wonderfully evocative way of describing what the layers of an onion are like. And it's something that we talk about all the time. And then at the end to say, and we weep, you know, obviously when you're cutting an onion, you know, sometimes you cry. But the idea that you could cry because you're recognizing that you're, you know, cutting into something that is that was once pure and that was once whole is something that that really resonates with me.
Well, also, I'd like that reading it once again, common onion layered with pliant translucent imitations, echoes of itself, shows us the power of ordinary things, and we weep.
Yeah.
What I liked about that is that, you know, this is something that I'm always trying to kind of figure out how to impress upon my children. You know, they're like surrounded by, you know, media, which is by definition kind of a mediated experience. I'm trying to constantly get them to look at the real thing.
Sure.
Like, why look at the imitation when you can have the real thing? So whenever they do, they actually look out at a sunset. It makes me want to weep. I'm like, yes. And whenever they look out at a sunset or a beautiful cloud and say, look, Mom, it just makes me feel like I want to weep. So anyway, that's what it meant to me. So thank you for that.
Of course. Thank you
for giving me a moment. Vinny Vanga, do you have any advice about how to get started or master this form, especially for somebody who said you have a love-hate relationship with it? I'm sure a lot of us do.
All the poets whom I love are able to trust seeing and a certain way, a felt vulnerable imagination. I don't know, which terrifies prose people. So yes, allow yourself to be vulnerable and see. It teaches you to see.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you so much. That's Binya Vanga Wainaina from Dakar, Senegal. Tope Falerin, both of them winners of the Kane Prize for excellence in the short story form by African writers, both kind enough to join us from their respective cities. Thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you for participating.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now to matters of personal finance. We often talk about ways to keep more money in your wallet, whether through better budgeting or avoiding scams, but it turns out there's some money that might actually be sitting around trying to get into your pockets. How is this possible, you say? Unclaimed funds. It turns out, according to our friend, consumer columnist Cheryl Harris, you often have money tucked away that you didn't know about, just like those coins in the sofa cushion, only better. Right, Cheryl?
Exactly. Lots better.
Are there any figures on how much unclaimed money is out there?
I don't know an aggregate figure, but there are billions of dollars. And New York State alone holds $12 billion for residents. Each and every state holds unclaimed funds. Municipalities hold them. Counties hold them. State governments hold a lot because they're the repositories for stuff that comes from businesses. And then the federal government also holds unclaimed funds.
How is this possible? I think that some people might be listening to this and saying, how is it possible that the government has money that you are owed that you don't know that they have? How is this possible? Where does this money come from?
Well, okay, so let's just take the IRS, for example. They're holding like $900 million for about 990,000 taxpayers who either had refunds that were undeliverable. The IRS tried to deliver them and they couldn't be delivered. Or, you know, maybe they didn't make enough to file in a certain year, so they never bothered to file, but they were still eligible to claim money. And actually, if you don't owe the government money, you can file a tax return even years later and collect that money. And the IRS holds it there for, you know, more than a decade, actually. They hold these funds in case you want to go back and reclaim a refund from another year. So that's one way. But more often, really, it's just that we forget about a bank account. We move and forget to tell our landlord where we're going, so he can't return our security deposit. Just little mistakes that we make, they wind up with businesses, and sooner or later, states say, hey, if you can't find this customer anymore, you have to turn the money over to us for safekeeping, and they hold it until you claim it.
Or those savings bonds that used to be popular.
Exactly.
And they mature, and you forgot about it, and...
Right. The Treasury holds, you know, millions of dollars in, you know, savings bond, T-bills, all of that stuff, and they're all in unclaimed slush funds.
So the big question, how do you find out if there is some money waiting for you?
Well, I wish it were really easy, but you have to squirrel around.
See, there,
to a bunch
there you
of
go.
Different
you set us
places.
Up, and now we're all excited.
No.
To think
it's
that we got some cash
than...
coming, and you're saying now it's going to be hard. Okay, go ahead.
Well, the easiest place to start is to go to your state unclaimed funds repository. It's your state government. Unclaimed.org will take you to all of those sites, jumping off sites for all those states.
So you start with unclaimed.org, and then
right.
you go figure out. Where, not just where you live now, but where you used to live, right?
Exactly. And then you can search for relatives in whatever states they were also in. And it's possible that you could claim as an heir unclaimed funds that were left to, you know, an ancestor. In fact, there are also unclaimed inheritances that counties hold. But I think the easiest place to start is with the state. And then you might work your way to the federal government and look for those the bonds. There are unclaimed pensions that the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation holds, you know, companies that went out of business and transferred their pensions for safekeeping there. There are railroad pensions that are also unclaimed. And a good place to start for those federal searches is USA.gov. And that's just a general, you know, where, you know, clearinghouse for government information. And if you put unclaimed funds in the search, you'll get a page of a bunch of likely websites that you can spring off to that are federal sites that hold unclaimed funds for
now,
you.
Now, previously, though, you have warned us against services that charge a fee to get you services that are actually free to you. I mean, if it's a service and you really don't have time to do it, you know, maybe it's worth it to you to pay a fee. Is there something you should be thinking about?
Yes.
Along
okay.
those
so
lines.
There are yeah. companies called finders, and very often they're hired by companies to hook up people who have unclaimed funds with a company before it has to turn it over to the state. So sometimes they have a little bit of window of time. If you wait, those funds will transfer to the state, and you can just get them free yourself later on. Anything a finder can do for you, you can do yourself for free. But I would say if you're tempted to use a finder, you should definitely check out the company with the Better Business Bureau first, because very often some of these companies want you to sign a release that gets them the funds, and some of them don't turn the money back over to the person. So I would be very sure of who you're working with if you attempt to do it. But it is a blast to go on these websites and look for your name and find it. And I would say, just for fun, get together with your family, get online, look for unclaimed funds. It's a blast, and it's even more fun if you find something.
Okay, that's how Cheryl has fun. Great. Some of us want to go to see Captain America. I'm just saying. But so thank you for this. It's like a happy story, something you could do maybe on a rainy afternoon. But
exactly.
Is there a way that you would recommend that if you say to yourself, you know, I might be guilty of this, I might be leaving money on the table, or you're about to move or something like that.
Yeah.
Is there something you want to tell people to be sure that they do so they don't wind up having, you know, their kids having to hunt down their, you know, unclaimed bank accounts later, however fun
yeah.
it may be?
Definitely, when you move, fill out a change of address form. But in addition to that, notify every business that you do, you know, business with, your banks, your landlord, your, you know, utilities companies. Notify them of your next address so they can send you refunds if you were due those. That's the biggest way things get lost. And when you fill out a change of address form and you move and you find an important letter that comes with that forwarding, you know, sticker on it, contact that company and tell them where you are now. The biggest way people get out of touch with their money is they lose touch with the businesses that have it.
I bet a lot of people are in this situation where they have a parent who maybe falls ill and dies before revealing where all the bank accounts are and things of that sort. And you say to yourself, you know, okay, I've finally gotten all this paperwork done. Now I want to go on a search for perhaps unclaimed bank accounts owned by a parent. For example, or an elderly relative for whom you have been responsible. What do you do if you are not the account holder yourself, but you are a child or an heir? What do you do?
Well, if they're living and you have a power of attorney, then you should be able to go and claim the funds. You would want to talk with an attorney if you're trying to reclaim bank funds from a bank, because banks have really strict standards about that. If they're deceased, you can often claim the unclaimed funds as long as you have a death certificate and, say, your birth certificate. You can show your relationship. You can show you were the heir of that person. So there's a way to do that. But I want to tell you a cautionary tale about safe deposit boxes. some states actually will scoop up the property in the boxes and safekeep it for you. Mm. But many states, including Ohio, don't. They only keep cash. And that means when a safe deposit box goes unclaimed for a certain period of time, the bank can have the box drilled open, can auction off the property, can take its proceeds out of the cash, all its costs out of the cash, and then move the rest of the cash to the state. And I've had families who've lost really lovely heirloom jewelry or sentimental things with sentimental value, important documents like love letters and adoption papers, things that are only of value to them, but that can't be transferred to the state for safekeeping. So if your relative has a safe deposit box, I would talk to them very carefully about whether they're current on the rent or if they can tell you where the box is and where the key's kept just in case there's ever an emergency, because you'll need that.
Hmm. Good advice. Cheryl Harris is consumer columnist for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. She was with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michelle. It's always fun.
Just ahead, this is a subject that comes up from time to time in our parenting conversations. We so often hear how moms would handle things, but what would dad do? Father of seven, Robert Nichols, said nobody seems to ask, so he is.
We really want to do it ourselves, and we want to have our own learning curve. If we go out of the house and we forget a diaper, then we got to figure out how to deal with it.
We'll hear more about his new web-based talk show, My Life as a Dad. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years, and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
Garrison Keillor, host of A Prairie Home Companion, flies into Central Illinois on Wednesday, May 7th at 11:30 a.m. to read from his new book, The Keillor Reader. WILL has a limited number of tickets available for this very special fundraiser at Frasca Field in Urbana. Copies of the book will be available for Garrison to sign, and lunch will be provided. For more information and to purchase a ticket, visit WILL.illinois.edu or call 800-898-1065.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. What makes economic sanctions work? We'll look at the effect they've had in North Korea and Iran and ask, are there lessons to be learned as the U.S. tries to use sanctions to get Russia to back off in Ukraine? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Our broadcast day is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming you to a musical gathering with cherished favorites Nathan and Julie Gunn and Friends on Thursday, May 1st at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And yes, okay, we admit it. We're more likely to hear from moms than dads. Why is that? Well, maybe because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of parenting blogs and books written by and for mothers. Maybe because mothers are more used to talking to each other about being parents. But if you are a father, you probably know this. A lot of fathers are trying to change that. And one dad has put his money where his mouth is and, with his own money, has created a web-based show by fathers for fathers.
Welcome to My Life as a Dad. We all know any man can be a father, but it takes someone special to be a daddy.
That's Robert Nickel, host of the new web-based show, My Life as a Dad. It features Nickel in conversation with celebrity dads from a variety of backgrounds. Nickel is a father of seven, and somehow or another he found time to be with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. I'm delighted to be here today.
How did the idea for a show happen? Were you watching a show or listening to a show that had no dad representation in it? You were thinking, well, wait a minute, what does dad have to say about that? Or was there something like that?
Right. I talked to a lot of dads, and a lot of dads would say, you know, yeah, I sort of read this book, and I didn't really read it. I read like the first chapter, and I kind of put it down, or I pretended to read it, you know, for my wife. And I was trying to think of, you know, like, what's another medium that we could use to reach dads and help educate them? And a lot of dads who are having their babies in their 20s or are young, they look up to celebrities or they look up to athletes. And so I wanted to create a show, which is basically just a 3-minute pop with some advice from somebody that somebody can really listen to. Like maybe they really like this NFL player and they're going to go, wow, he grew up without a mom and a dad and look where he's at and look how he loves his kids or look how he really feels about supporting his wife. And I feel like if you can make a man a better dad, you can make a better child. You can make a better child. You can make a future better dad. And I think it's just good for society.
I was going to ask you why the focus on celebrities, because you interview celebrities from a variety of backgrounds, musicians, athletes, actors.
Well, what gave me the idea is people love talk shows, but the celebrity comes on and the celebrity talks about their next movie coming up or their next gig and they're off the air. And so to bring them on a show and say, we're all dads. Let's talk about being a dad. Let's talk about the funny. Let's talk about the hard. We've had a few guys have tears in their eyes on the show. And the audience, when they're listening to this, what I'm hoping is that they're going to watch and go, you know what? I really like Tom Arnold, or I really like Aaron Christian Olsen or Chris Paul. And they're going to take a moment and they're going to listen to what he has to say. And if we can help to change their life, that's the goal.
Let me just play a short clip from the interview with Tom Arnold. He has a 6-month-old.
The first time I had him alone for 2 hours, I was in there looking at him in the nursery, and he was crabby, but I just wanted to take it in. And all of a sudden I hear, pick him up. And I'm like, who's talking? And she was at Neiman Marcus watching me.
That's hilarious.
That's creepy. It's creepy. It's weird.
So they obviously have a security system where she can, you know, check, yes. You know, remotely. But you called her out on this. You have a term for this. It's called backseat mommy.
Right? Backseat mommy.
Backseat
that's
mommy.
Right.
And you talked to Tom Arnold about that. I may, hypothetically, have engaged in this conduct at some point.
Backseat momming, what I call that is dads, we want to try. And, you know, we're going to fail a little bit. We're not going to do it as good as mom does because mom's just a pro. She's got everything now. My wife will think of the next 25 things that need to happen throughout the entire day as she's planning her diaper bag or her pack. That's where me as a dad, I think of the next hour ahead of me. And, you know, it's just the way that guys and women think. But from a dad standpoint, we really want to fail on our own. We really want to do it ourselves, and we want to have our own learning curve. If we go out of the house and we forget a diaper, then we got to figure out how to deal with it. And we will figure out how to deal with it, and then we'll pack our diaper bag better the next time.
So you ask a lot of basic questions, like what's your philosophy on discipline? What do you do about sleep time, for example?
So 6-month-old, are you done with sleeping through the night, or is that happening?
Why do you do that?
I do it because I think everybody has a different reaction. I was sort of looking for a commonality. Is there really a universal commonality here of how everybody does sleep training, and there's not? Or did it really all come from how they were raised? And sometimes they emulate their parents of how they were raised, or they completely do the opposite of it. But the commonality that I find is that they love their kids. I mean, that's one thing that you're going to hear throughout all the messages is, you know, I love my kids. I really love them, and that's what I want to do. But the other thing, I ask the questions too because I'm genuinely interested myself. And I actually am becoming a better dad every day myself, every day I do one of these interviews, because I'm learning, I'm listening to what they're saying. I'm like, yeah, wow, that's really good. That's a good point.
So you do have a lot of fun with your guests, but you also get into some really tough issues at times. And I mentioned Tom Arnold earlier, and he disclosed in the course of the interview that he had been molested as
right.
a child. And he talked about how to talk about this with your own kids. First of all, were you prepared for that? Did you know that that was going to happen? And what do you think of that?
No, I wasn't prepared for it at all. I actually talked with Tom for almost 3 hours that day. And he is just a very, very deep individual. And having his son come into his life really like woke him up. And he's like re-energized, recharged. He wants to do what's right for his child. And I think that a lot of that was, you know, cleansing for him to talk to me as another dad. I can relate to a lot of dads because of having four in my 20s and three in my 50s. And I've been divorced and I've been remarried. And Tom is just a really sincere guy. No, I wasn't expecting that at all to come from him, but it was a very truthful thing that he said and something that he is working through and putting behind him and something that he never would want to have happen to his own son.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Robert Nickel. He is host of the web show about parenting. It's by a dad, aimed at dads, and it's called My Life as a Dad. You have scored some really big interviews. I was hearing from your representatives that, in fact, you have not had difficulty getting some people to talk about this. I think some people might be surprised that some people who are really big stars do want to come and talk about this. Why do you think that they're attracted to this opportunity?
I think that deep down inside, guys are proud to be the dad. And I look at it back on the days of all the sitcom shows. You always had the dad, like the Archie Bunker and the Mr. Brady and the Bill Cosby. It's all about the family and being proud to be the dad. And I think that the celebrities and athletes that we've talked to and the musicians, they like talking about being a dad. And it's good for them to just to talk about it with me. I think they leave the show being a better dad than when they came to the show. I leave the show being a better dad. And I think that they agree to do it because they just are very proud to be dads.
In one of the episodes, you spoke with NBA player Chris Paul in the news right now. One might say the biggest name at the LA Clippers right now. He's also a major figure in the NBA Players Association. Here he is talking about being a dad. Here's Chris Paul.
I could care less how much money you make, and I tell people all the time, my kids are the most important thing to me, and being with them and being around them. Anytime I have to go somewhere, it kills me. I hate it. I hate traveling now, because my son is old enough, and he'll tell me, Dad, I'm going to miss you while you're gone. Why are you leaving me?
I, again, wonder whether this might surprise some people that a professional athlete, somebody who's as well recognized as Chris Paul would have those kinds of feelings. So I was wondering if it surprised you, or do you look for people who kind of contradict the stereotypes that some people might have?
I take every interview just completely open-minded, and I just want to hear what they have to say. And Chris Paul, I mean, his son was there the entire time. I mean, in between little breaks, he'd run in with French fries and grab this and grab that. And just as you could see Chris Paul's sincerity for how much he loves his son, I mean, it was there. I mean, it was 100% true. And Chris is going to be a great dad, and his kids are going to be extremely lucky to have him as a dad.
I noticed that often the interview subjects bring their kids to the set with them. Is that something you encourage them to do, or did that just happen?
So once we built out the new studio, we built an area called the playroom, which when my kids see it on the show, they think it's theirs. They're like, what are those kids doing in our playroom, Dad? But yeah, we encourage them to bring their kids down, because a lot of people, they always see mom. They see mom at the stores, or maybe they see dad at the amusement park, but they don't often see dad just sitting on the floor interacting with his kids.
Are you ever tempted to correct any of your guests? I mean, do they ever say things that you don't agree with?
I have had a few where I thought, you know, I really need to like maybe have a daddy session with them later and really talk about a few things.
Did you edit that out or did you leave it in?
On the particular individual I'm thinking of, we left it in. We didn't change it. My goal is not to correct or to judge anybody when I'm interviewing them. So my goal is to listen to what they have to say, discuss it with them, and move on to the next subject.
I want to mention among the people you've interviewed, I mentioned Tom Arnold, I mentioned Chris Paul. You also interviewed J.R. Martinez, who was a fan favorite on Dancing with the Stars. He's a severely injured veteran of the armed services from the Iraq war and has had some interesting stories about how he was competing as his wife was pregnant and, you know, trying to balance her needs with his. Anybody, do you have a favorite interview? And is there an interview you really wish you had or you really want to have?
Oh, there's lots of people that I would love to have on the show. Elon Musk, if he's listening, I'd love to have him on the show. But as far as a favorite so far, Erik Christian Olsen, I interviewed him before he ever had a baby. And then we're going to interview him again in the fall to talk about what it's like now, a year and a half later, you know, how he felt before and how it is now.
Hmm. Well, finally, how do you think this has changed you?
Well, we talk a lot about technology all the time. And, well, I'll listen to different dads and they'll say, like, you know, well, I'll put my cell phone down or I won't put my cell phone down or I try to have specific time. And just the fact of talking about the technology and the cell phones and things like that, when I walk into the house at night, I take my cell phone out now and I'll put it on the banister. And I'll make sure I spend a good amount of time with my kids where I'm not checking my emails or looking at my text messages. Another one is with listening to your kids. And Christian Hosoi, who I don't think his is up yet on the YouTube, but he was very, very down to earth as far as listening to his kids and relating to them and asking them about, you know, their feelings. And sometimes I don't necessarily, as a dad, I don't think about that myself, even though I'm doing this whole show. But I'm sitting on the couch with my kids and my son starts to say, you know, just something to me about the gym class that he was at. And I think to myself, oh, this is a listening moment. So I start encouraging him into the conversation. And the next thing you know, we've talked for 10, 12, 15 minutes about his gym. And I might not have done that otherwise. And so that's why I'm saying is it does make me a better dad, because it makes me more aware of what's going on.
Robert Nickel is the host of the web series My Life as a Dad. He's a father of seven, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Our studio's not as nice. They don't have as many things to play with as his studios, but, you know, we do our best. So, Robert Nickel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate it.
Finally today, one more perspective on parenting. Yes, she's a mom, but she's also a member of the Tell Me More family, and we think this is something you'll want to hear. Supervising editor Alicia Montgomery recently wrote an essay about a particular parenting challenge in her life for NPR's Code Switch blog, and we wanted to share it with you. Her piece was titled, Autism, Like Race, Complicates Almost Everything, and well, we'll let her tell you the rest. Here it is.
Children have tantrums. They yell and grab at things that they should ask for nicely. And when a child has autism, like my son, these episodes can be epic. Toys hurled across a room, screaming fits that last for hours, and flurries of hitting that get triggered by even a minor change in a routine. But when my son screams at his therapist and tries to snatch markers from his hands, I gasp. I think of Trayvon Martin. I'm black, and so is my son. And even though at that moment he's just 5 years old, I know that an angry swipe at a white man's hands could get him killed one day. At some of the toughest moments with my son, this therapist has been a sanity saver for me. A middle-aged white man, he has the warm, easy manner of everyone's favorite uncle. For my son, he has compassion and endless patience. But at this moment, he's told my son not to do something, and my son has not only done it, he's also gotten physical. My instinct is to snatch my son up and hit him with everything I have, but I don't. I watch while his therapist waits for him to get the hollering and grabbing out of his system. After about 10 minutes, it all quiets down, but I'm still holding my breath. Generations of black parents have had to have the talk with our sons, the explanation that while they have a right to do everything a white kid does, exercising those rights under the wrong circumstances could be dangerous. And a transgression like the one my son has committed against his doctor, one that might get a white child arrested, could get him killed. It's hard to explain, and hard for many boys to understand at first. My kid still doesn't quite understand that he's expected to answer to his own name, or deal with a broken toy without screaming. These are not social graces, these are skills that most kids develop in their early years with no special training. Looking people in the eye, or saying hello, or sitting still in a chair. He has to practice these things several hours a week with a team of therapists at home and at his special school. It's costing a fortune, but he's getting better. Many parents of autistic kids don't have my options. They don't have the money or the understanding employer or the family and community support that I do. Or what's most heartbreaking, their child's condition just doesn't respond to anything that they've tried. Most of our days now pass without problems, and when my son has a bad moment or a meltdown, He's surrounded by caring people who are trained to coax him into using his words. They know not to grab his arm or shout, and that it may take two or three times for him to respond to a question. But I know that black boys like my son, even the young ones, don't get the benefit of the doubt in real life. So what do I do? Take him out of the daycare where he's cherished like a son? Tell his open-hearted teachers to treat him with a little less tenderness than they do the other kids to help him toughen up? Or the next time he gets physical, have his therapist grab him by both wrists and tell him sternly to keep his hands to himself? Autism, like race, complicates almost everything, especially questions of who's privileged. Almost everyone with a child on the spectrum is living with constant anxiety and navigating from one crisis to another. When I'm with parents of kids with autism or other disabilities, I feel like I'm in one of those zones where race doesn't matter as much. There are conversations we have with each other that we can't have with anyone else. All of the parents, white, black, Latino, and Asian American, have to grapple with indifferent or hostile teachers, worry about cops who think their kids are acting strange or suspicious. They're fighting to create a place for their children to thrive in a world that views them as worthless or scary. And there's that fear, the one that I used to think only black parents really understood, that you could do everything right, spend every dime, minute, ounce of energy on your child, and it still might not be enough.
Alicia Montgomery is Tell Me More supervising editor and a mom of one. To read her essay, please go to the Code Switch page on NPR.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.